Hello everyone, my name is Terhi Tuomi and I'm the curator of Ryoji Ikeda's solo exhibition, on show at Amos Rex until February 2024. The internationally renowned Japanese composer and artist Ryoji Ikeda works with sound, rhythm, light, scientific images and data visualization. Drawing inspiration from physical phenomena and mathematical concepts, Ikeda translates this invisible material and data into performances and audiovisual installations. In this episode of Amos Rex podcast, you are warmly welcome to listen to a talk recorded during the opening ceremony of Ikeda's exhibition between the artist Ryoji Ikeda and US-based independent curator Mika Yoshitake. They are talking about Ikeda's long and multifaceted artistic career and what has shaped his practice. Yoshitake is specialized in post-war and contemporary Japanese art and has been following Ikeda's career since 2001.
Hello, good evening. I'm Ryoji Ikeda.
Hello.
Hello, Mika.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I am so sad not to be in Helsinki in person, but I know from all of the images and the videos that it looks spectacular. And I want to congratulate Ryoji and the team at Amos Rex. When I first saw your work 22 years ago at Ars Electronica back in 2001, a piece called Formula, it was a pitch black space with a grid of lights that flashed in pulsating synchrony, and the space oscillated between blinding light and absolute darkness. And it was intercut with these stroboscopic beams wiping across the screen. There was an audience waiting to see you perform, but you never came out. The atmosphere felt like it could be a screening or an experimental film or a concert or a live installation. At Amos Rex, I understand there are discrete sections that adapt to the architectural space through, you know, perceiving the world through this audiovisual translation of data. And it encompasses three unique aspects of your practice. So sound visualizations based on light, the entropic mapping of the universe, and the intimate scale of anatomic data. Can you speak about your approach when you experience the space and how it adapts to this unique underground spatial environment as a composer, as a composition?
I'm a composer who never be trained as a composer. So I'm kind of an uneducated person dropping out of school. But I use the word composer, composer who composes actually anything into artwork. So I compose sound into music. I compose space and time for the architectural, the condition into, you know, the art exhibition, etc. So for the Amos Rex, at the site visit, I already gave a proposal immediately, and they didn't like it, and they dropped it, and I just work it. It was too simple, but anyway, some echoes you can feel from the original proposal. And my job is to compose time and space of the unique Amos Rex exhibition space. And also my background is performing arts. So I kind of compose or fine-tuning the non-narrative flow of visitors from the entrance to the exit. I apply kind of notion of composition for any process of my activity as an artist.
You did training to get an electronic composer in the 1980s, which was an age that was this rise of postmodern amnesia, and you study the history of modern music, and you saw yourself kind of like a DJ manipulating records, cassettes, files. But I think, you know, what was interesting is that you were fascinated by the sound systems of the club. Can you tell us about this early journey and your own discovery of the physicality of sound as the subject of your work?
Mm-hmm. I really never be trained for anything. Everything is a self-taught. I came from really underground, you know, electronic music, like a DJ stuff. Totally non-intellectual background. I'm still keeping that, you know, level. I found sound could be really violent and powerful in a club because the speakers, it's like a weapon, consists of hundreds of speakers. And your eyeball is really, you know, trembling, and it's really, really physical. It's kind of unnecessary loud, but this is a kind of club culture. You would never learn this kind of physicality or threshold to your perception, light and sound, in the conservatory or university. You know, it's experience-based, like a bottom-up self-taught learning process I'm really doing.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the role of music. I know that it's not a specific genre or a context that is specifically Japanese or anything. You're part of a larger international zeitgeist, from, you know, music concrete to artists and musicians who are interested in audiovisual installations that use data, light, sound in a very pure form. So I wonder, you know, what if you can talk a bit about the context from which you first came out of. You were an engineer and producing the sounds for Dumbtype, the multimedia performance group in the 1980s that really addressed the AIDS crisis and was a very humanity-based group that was also dealing with technology and that kind of disconnect between humanity and technology. So you created a, I guess, unique sound system and environment for that era. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about what shaped your practice from that point, from the 1980s to the present.
Okay. I joined in a Japanese artist collective called Dumbtype during the 90s, like 10 years or 12 years. And we tour everywhere, all over the world. So we created performing arts piece, the stage art, and roughly 15, 20 members, but we didn't have a leader. It's totally democratic, horizontal. It's a really utopian leftist, you know, idea, but it's really tough. When you try to change the position of the chair on the stage from here to here, 3 nights discussion without any conclusion. Democracy sucks, really. But anyway, we tour everywhere and we didn't know anything. Each person has a different kind of background. And some people attended art college at the university, and people like me is dropping out. So always going to a good club. And we just invented our way how to make the piece, and of course to work with the local technician in the theater. So my practice is based on that. So that collective functioned school for me. I learned everything, all the production process, engineering, technically, production, you know, budget and things. We made everything all together. That practice, that experience is really formed me, you know, it's really important.
When you performed, you said you traveled and toured throughout not just Japan, but throughout the world. And this was the 90s. And how did the context evolve? How did you kind of mature out of that process?
Yeah. I had a lot of ideas when I was working with Dumbtype. But of course, you know, not always my idea is realized. Of course, it's like a democracy, you know. You know, one big performing arts piece, stage piece. My idea, some part, is realized, but many ideas dropped. But good thing is I can really criticize about the choreography. And dancers really pointed out this is not good for lighting designer. And set designer really said something about my music. This is too loud. This is bullshit. It's really, really free and really chaotic. But this is how to learn each other. And the beginning was really like that, but in the, after 10 years, it's, everything was purely, it's even a bit too sophisticated. The beginning was we are blacklisted in the many theaters because we didn't know how to make it, and technicians are boycotted, you know. they didn't show up for the day of the show. And but luckily, it's always a standing ovation, and the technicians came to us next day. But anyway, so we learned everything, not only like artistic practice, because we are a bit like a child. Everything was childish, and we learned how to function as a human in a society. We learned everything during the tour. Some ideas were dropped for the dumb type, and I tried to reuse my ideas, and it's naturally evolved. It's basically starting sound and the visual, a light, and the data, and architectural context, and the public art. It's really it's expanding. I do everything at the same time. And I still feel I'm totally amateur. I'm learning all the time. And when I was invited to give a lecture or to teach at the university, and it's really strange because I hate school. And why I have to go to school in 50 something years old? And I was really so strange, struggling, you know. I'm still learning. And also I'm happy to be with the young generations always. I learn from their generation and with my child and, you know.
Well, in parallel with your performance collaboration with Dumb Type, you produced albums. And your first album was 1,000 Fragments from 1995, which consisted of a dense layering of samples that telescoped different musical genres and used thousands of fragments to build a long soundscape. However, as you know, your work has matured, there is this kind of refined simplicity of your multimedia practice, which has been described as neo-modernist, as part of this kind of neo-modern generation of sound artists who undertake an investigation that's at once spiritual and scientific, into the basic forms of aesthetic matter and fundamental conditions of perception. Do you feel you are in dialogue with this neo-modernist engage as opposed to the more kind of spatial temporal collapse that defines postmodern practice?
Yeah, thank you for placing me in such a kind of a context. But I should leave everything to critics. I can't analyze myself, you know, my activity, you know, I cannot be objective, you know, what I've seen. I'm writing classical music now, and experimental music, and a different industry, in fact, you know. I'm just traveling in the context, in the structure of art. So somebody has to write, you know. You write very good to me, but I think it's, for me, I have nothing to say about this kind of thing. Yeah,
well, it seems there's a versatility to your practice. It's not just one, you know, trajectory, and then which makes it so interesting. So in 2000, you began addressing light as a medium with spectra, and also assembling light and sound with data magics. So working with light and sound as raw material for the last two decades, you also engaged in a collaborative research project with German electric composer and artist Karsten Nikolai called Cyclo. And that consisted of a visual index of micro sound waves that derived from complex harmonic motions using the mastering of vinyl records. You produced these geometric images called Lissajou figures that are generated from overlapping layers of sounds, sometimes created from unusual sounds that are out of oral range through a microscopic editing process. And you kind of created this encyclopedia or infinity index. I understand with the current kinetic laser installation, SPIN, there are this laser rotating ellipses, and I wondered if there is a relationship from work that you have done since the 2000s in relation to the correlation?
I can draw some figures, geometric figures by sound.
And I use a kind of oscilloscope or all those things, like engineers' devices, including computers and the programming thing. As same as DJs scratching vinyls. So misuse is a kind of taboo for engineers, but for me, it's kind of start point. Really play with that standard machine, for example. I use completely extreme way. Then I found something interesting. So I eliminate all the functionality of that device, and I really see as an object and what this machine can do. And of course, lots of errors for professionals, but lots of inspirations for artists.
That's so interesting. So you almost make the error into part of the experience, part of the sound, part of what we, you know, hear. I feel like throughout your career, your work has pushed this boundary of human perception. And you've described your work in terms of the sublime, stating that the sublime is the only kind of word that can justify my experience through my art. The experience is so instant. It's almost impossible to explain that experience in words. It's a bit like a taste we are feeling. And you also say that mathematical beauty is really beautiful because it's so rational. Pythagorean theorem, the Platonic sphere. Beauty is beauty, but sublime is beyond or completely different expansion. It's like the notion of infinity. So in relation to the sublime, what I see also is that your work masters the art of the subliminal, which is recognizing sensory stimuli below the threshold of cognition or conscious perception. And your work kind of produces the response. What do you think about this idea of subliminal versus the sublime, reflecting back on your practice?
I think that is difficult to answer. But, you know, I think words have a certain limit. So I try to make something we cannot explain by words. For example, music, a simple music, Mozart melody. You see? How you explain the melody of the music? And you can read score, you can see the score, but this is not music. Music is really invisible. You can't see it. It's just vibration of air, but organized mathematically. But when you listen to the music, how you explain that sensation and the feeling? And when you're eating, like, carbonara, for example, how you explain? Of course, sublime is a really, really big theme, but it's more like from everyday life. I try to really make something we cannot really explain by words. If I can explain, I don't need to make it. I just write the text and then it's the finish. And especially the exhibition this time, the new piece, it's a newborn baby. It just completed 3 days ago. And I cannot explain. It's, of course, too new. But you will get it. You just feel. You have the sense. And the people can probably interpret differently. Each person has different. And then it forms. Maybe description or explanation afterwards by people. This is the best way for me. I always say I make half. Visitors completed the rest. And then it's really balanced. And the music too, if there's no listeners or audience, I have a big question. Even very abstract things, even austere, minimalist, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I need audience. I need people. So its function is in the society. I'm doing art, which cannot be explained by words, but I try to function it for people. It's kind of a new experience for everyday life.
Thank you for listening to this Amos Rex podcast. The exhibition is open until 25th of February. You are warmly welcome to see it.